Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
When Jackie Shannon Hollis was growing up on a farm in Oregon, she expected to become a mother someday. When she met the man she wanted to spend her life with, he said he did not want children. In her memoir, This Particular Happiness, Jackie Hollis explores what we keep and what we abandon to make space in our lives for love, and her complicated decision not to have a child. Jackie Shannon Hollis, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm really happy to be talking with you. Yeah, and to share my book.
Yeah, and by way of introduction, really, I would like for you to start right off reading from your chapter, We Practiced, We Pretended. Do you have that page open?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you ready?
Yes.
We practiced, we pretended. During my childhood in the 1960s, almost all the women in our small town were mothers. They had 2, 3, 5, 8 children. By the time mom was 24, she had 4 kids, Pat, Brad, Leanne, and me, the youngest. The mothers of Condon drove big Bodie cars or station wagons with kids piled all the way into the back. Some of the women worked. Mom worked when money was tight. She started her first job as an assistant to the local doctor when I was 6 years old. Even though she wasn't a nurse, she wore a white dress and white shoes with rubber soles that sounded like whispers when she walked. Her job seemed like that too, a whisper compared to the shout of motherhood. More important than helping their husbands on the land or working in the offices and stores was that these women were our mothers. They cooked and baked, cleaned and washed, knitted and sewed. They watched us go off into backyards or barns or canyons to play. They dropped us off at the swimming pool every day of summer. They called us in to eat, checked homework and dirty hands, bathed us and cut our hair, read to us and sang to us. They took turns bringing cookies and decorations to school holiday parties, threw birthday parties, organized Cub Scouts and 4-H and brownies. They gathered to drink coffee and teach each other crafts, crochet and knitting, sewing and macrame and upholstery. They taught these things to their daughters, how to do everything. They were pretty and smart and strong, my mom most of all. When she brought treats to school parties, she dressed in the latest, slim and lipsticked. Her dark hair showed off high cheekbones and the angled lines of her jaw. She brought Valentine cupcakes with frosting hearts, Christmas tree cookies with silver beads for ornaments. I made sure everyone knew she was my mom. I wanted to be like her. And above all, the one thing I never questioned was that I would be a mother too.
This is Jackie Shannon Hollis, and she's reading her from her book, This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. Now, Jackie, in this little bit that you read, you comment on your mother's hair color, and so often in your book, you comment on hair color and eye color. Why do you bring that up?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, something that's always interesting about writing is what people notice, and I'm very, what I would say about that is that I'm very visual, and I was also taught very much growing up to pay attention to appearances. It was a thing that my mother was very conscious of, and I think she passed that on to her girls.
Because I remember, happened to be in Peru at the time, and this lady was commenting on how pretty, if my husband and I had a baby, it would have blonde hair and blue eyes, mm-hmm. as if that was the gold standard. And you often comment on whether the person has blonde hair and blue eyes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, one other thing about that is in my family, there were 5 kids ultimately. In this writing, there were 4, but then my younger sister came along when I was 8. And there were ways that we were distinguished by, you know, this is the, I'm left-handed and my brother is left-handed and my father is left-handed. I had brown hair. My sister Leanne had blonde hair and Chris was somewhere in between. And we, it was something that was often commented on in different ways. You know, and brown eyes and blue eyes. Two of us had brown eyes and three of us had blue eyes. So just those differences were topics of conversation in the family as ways that we could make ourselves special or unique, I think.
Well, you did mention that a younger sibling came along after mm-hmm. you were writing this, and this was a younger sister who was named Chris. And mm-hmm. you, it took me back to when I was going to have a younger brother, and my older, well, after he was born, and my older brother was displeased to have another baby in the family. And,
yes,
and
uh-huh.
you used the word pouted to describe your reaction to your mother's pregnancy.
Well, and yes, I mean, because, and that was the other thing about these distinctions in the family was one of the roles that I had, and I write about this, was that I was the baby of the family, and that was the one thing that made me special. And I was also eight, which I think may be an age given to pouting. So, I because it was interesting, my older sister, Leanne, loved the idea of having a little sister, and maybe in some ways that was a prescient for what ended up happening, because my sister ended up having children, my older sister, and, you know, loving that whole experience where I didn't end up having children. But yes, I pouted, and then I ended up falling in love with her, my little sister.
Well, you quote your mother as saying, "Can't you be nice, be happy for someone else?" And you say, being nice was a big thing in our family.
Uh-huh, yes,
and Dad said, if that lower lip sticks out any farther, a bird's going to come along. And anyway, so you're pouting because you have this younger sister. Uh-huh. And I would like to skip now to the very last paragraph in that chapter, Jackie, if you don't mind reading that.
Let me find that.
Well,
real quick.
You were saying that in this world you took care of your younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh yes,
you
okay.
helped her.
So the last paragraph of the chapter. This is what I did. That let me just make sure I've got this right. This is what I did. This is what my girlfriends did with dolls, with little sisters and brothers, with the children we babysat. We pretended. We practiced. We prepared. Our mother said to us, "When you grow up." When you have your own children, no question, we would grow up. We would have children of our own.
My guest is Jackie Hollis, and she's reading from her book, This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. And you're saying that in the town that you grew up in, rural Oregon, this mm-hmm. is what you did when you were growing up. You and your friends babysat, and that's mm-hmm. the title of this chapter, We Pretended, We Practiced, because mm-hmm. it was a given that when you grew up, you were going to have your own children. Mm-hmm. No question.
Yes, yes. The generation was very much that way. There were no examples, really, or very few examples, my great Aunt Lena being one of them, of women who didn't have children.
Well, I liked, although we don't learn much about your Aunt Lena, mm-hmm. I really liked her.
Oh, that's good. I did too.
Yeah. And yet your mother, what did your mother say about your Aunt Lena?
Well, she told me she was worried when she found out that I wasn't going to have children because she was afraid that I would end up being a bitter, lonely old woman like my Aunt Lena. And that was such a surprise to me because it was not how I experienced Aunt Lena at all. I experienced her as someone who always made us laugh and smile and who just loved us dearly. And I never experienced any bitterness about her. At all.
And yet that was the way your mother saw her. Your mother mm-hmm. characterized her as mm-hmm. being bitter. And I recall that when you brought this up to your mother sometime later, she didn't even remember saying that.
Right. I think that's an interesting thing about both, you know, how we are with children and how our own memories work. She didn't. She was surprised that she'd said it. And I think about this often when I'm interacting with the young people in my life, about the power of statements, things that we say that land on them, but for us may be something light, something that isn't that big a deal. And it happens all the time with anyone, really, whether it's a child or a young person or a friend, a peer, that we can say something that digs in deeply and not even realize it.
In fact, I hear so many stories of something a father will say to a son, and the father just almost says it in passing, doesn't give it much thought, and it just breaks my heart to hear the effect on the son, no matter what age
right.
they can be.
Yeah, the children, children, especially young ones, just take that in and carry it as if it's a truth.
And your book is full of these kinds of things that touch one's heart, I find, the reader. And I don't know how typical I am of your readers, but I'm a very avid reader of your book. I don't know if men, do you have any idea of whether men, percentage of your readers?
Because
I would think women would really, are just, it's a page-turner for women.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. I love hearing that. I would say in regards to the men who have read it so far, because it isn't going to be released until October 1st, I've had several men read it who've responded very positively to it and have found some of their own stories in it. Quite a section of the book, there are a number of vignettes that have to do with my husband, Bill, and his story and me trying to understand his story of why he didn't want to have children. And in this place, I think there are a number of men who relate, but also men who relate just in terms of looking at a relationship and how a relationship can navigate a big difference like this. So I think that they found something important for them there in it. I just finished narrating the audio version of this book, and the sound engineer was a young man, probably mid-30s, and he happened to be someone who has not planning to have children. He's married, and he and his wife aren't going to have kids. And he was quite responsive to the whole story, and just very interested in the topic. And so I think a lot of younger people are exploring being child-free these days. And so it's maybe a bigger audience in that sense.
My guest is Jackie Hollis, and we're discussing her book, her memoir, This Particular Happiness. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with my guest, Jackie Shannon Hollis, and she has written a memoir about her decision not to have children. Well, some of the adjectives that people have applied to your book, I mentioned, I found it moving. They also use the word brave, honest and intimate, that you don't keep secrets. Why do you suppose somebody would say you were brave? I know why I thought you were brave to write what you wrote, but what have people told you? Why do they think you're brave?
Well, I was just having a conversation with a friend about this the other day, because when a person is described as brave, often their own internal experiences, well, I was just doing what I did. It wasn't bravery. I think about people who do brave physical acts to save someone else, and they say, well, I couldn't have imagined. I just did it. I wasn't thinking. With writing this, I think that one of the reasons, or probably the biggest reason, is that I do reveal a lot about myself, both my own what I would call my dark side, my pouting, my jealousies, my pleading. I write about my early sexual activities, about sexual assault. That's not a big part of the story, but it's definitely part of it. And I think just for so many people, it's a surprise for someone to maybe speak so plainly or directly about these things, not with necessarily anger or neediness, but just this is who I am. And I was just talking with my little sister on the phone the other day about, just what it's going to be like to have this story out there. And there are quite a few personal things in it. And she said, but, that's why you write, is to share that. And it's why people read, is to feel less alone and less, that their own secrets seem, they hold less shame.
Well, growing up on a farm, you were exposed to sex, if I want to put it that way, in a way that city girls are not. And one of my favorite scenes, Jackie, is you and your dad and your granddad are there on the farm, and your dad stood up for you. Said, well, yeah, she's a girl, but tell us that. What happened?
Yes. Yeah, that was, we saw birth happening quite a lot on the farm. It wasn't unusual to see, a cow out in the pasture giving birth. I watched cats and dogs give birth. But this particular scene was a moment. We had a horse, a mare, who had gotten in some difficulty giving birth. She had the colt was breech in her, and she was just having a really difficult time. And so granddad brought someone out to the farm, a man in town who helped tours us through this. He wasn't really a vet, but he knew what he was doing. And so I went out to watch, and we were out there. There was a pickup pulled in so the lights could shine in there and they could see what they were doing in the barn. And I was quietly sitting up on a fence rail, and my grandfather saw me and said, I shouldn't be there. And what I was watching was this mare, and she was very still, but the man had one of his arms clear up inside her, trying to turn that colt so it could come out. And eventually it did. But my grandfather told my father, Jackie, she shouldn't be here. And my father said, she can be here. And it was a very profound moment for me, because there were these dividing lines between what girls could do and couldn't do on the ranch.
Especially on the farm, yes.
And so for me to have my father stand up to me after there had been other things where, I wasn't allowed or wasn't taught, having a pig for 4-H was not a girl thing. But this was a place that I could be, was to witness birth.
My guest is Jackie Hollis, and she has lived her whole life in Oregon, and she grew up on a farm, and she is telling us what it was like growing up on a farm with the animals. And I was also, I liked your favorite animal, Jackie, was what?
Lambs. Yes, I love them. And my dad would get, for several years in a row, he would get these bummer lambs. There was a sheep rancher nearby who had a lot of sheep. And some of those sheep would be rejected by the ewe, or the ewe had died, the mother had died. And so dad would bring out, a handful of these bummer lambs, and we would bottle feed them. And I just adored them. They were, they're just little lambs are the cutest thing. I don't know if you've ever seen them out in a pasture, and they're just so springy on their legs, and their tails are still long. They dock tails of the lambs. So they're pretty cute when they're little. And we got to bottle feed them. And that was an experience I shared with my dad, was going out to the barn in the cold weather and feeding these little lambs. There were even times where we had, we had a calf inside our house that was, it was in the dead of winter, and I think the cow had died. I'm not really sure what had happened to her, but we had that calf in our front room for a day or two in a big cardboard box, because it would have died if it was out where it was icy.
Well, I want to move ahead, Jackie, to when you get to high school. And I was talking to a friend of mine about this book, and you use the adjective for yourself, slut. And when I said that word, he said, "Did she write that?" And I said, "Yes, she did." I guess they maybe thought I was calling you that, but I was not. And this is one of the things I think other people who read your book and say, well, you don't keep secrets and you are brave. You called yourself that. Why would you call yourself a slut, Jackie?
Well, this was a term of the time. The times back then, this was in the mid-1970s. And at that time, there was permission. I think this is maybe to some extent still true, but I think it certainly was back then. Boys were encouraged, cheered on about having sex. And for girls, it was, you were supposed to wait till marriage. And I did not do that.
Like your older sister, Leanne.
Yes, like my older sister, huh? Yes, that's what she did. And I think that some of this came from just being, I was an explorer and I discovered my own sexuality quite early. And so I was aware of what my own body could do, but I was also very boy focused. And I think that I had a longing for male attention at that age. And that came in some sense from having my father be distant because he was drinking quite heavily during that time. He later became sober, but he was drinking during that time and was more absent than present. And I'd had an older brother who I adored who was just old enough that he had kind of moved on, and I missed him. And anyway, became very boy focused. And somehow in my kind of confused understanding at that age, confused sort of attention as I had to do something to get it, and that was sex. And so it was a combination of my own physical desire, but also something that had probably gone sideways in my own clarity about what my wants and needs were and what were a boy's wants and needs. And so I was quite sexually active during that time. And the term for girls back then who were as active as I was that you were a slut. And I had someone call me that. And so I used it in that particular paragraph to sort of show this, all of the contrasts of me, which I think we are all full of such contrasts. I was prom queen, a princess. I was a May Day queen. I was the setter on the volleyball team. I did all of these things, honor society president, and I had this other secret life.
Because you had all these other honors and recognitions. Mm-hmm, you were popular. Yeah. So you didn't need to, like some girls I think would go the route you did, as you call it, a slut. Because out of this lack of recognition, but you were popular and you did well academically, so you didn't need it for that reason. But this brings up that question of why do we want what we want?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not an easy question to answer, but you explore it in your book.
Yes. Yes. And that is, I mean, that is a through line in the book is, yeah, why do we want what we want? And is it our own body longing, for instance, wanting to have a child, or my you know what went on for me sexually as a teenager, or is there external pressure? When I look at the desire to have a child, there was generational pressure, family expectations, community expectations. So it's this ongoing process of trying to understand what do I want, and I think particularly women are raised to not to lose sight of what our own needs are, what our own wants are, and to be pleasing, to be nice, to figure out what that other person wants, and to lose track of our own desires.
Well, I see this happening. People make decisions because they don't really know themselves. And so part of this struggle that we have is to be our most authentic selves. I remember a quote from Ellen DeGeneres saying, "Find out who you are and be that person."
Yes. Yeah.
And you explore how can we be our most authentic selves.
Yes. And I think it's very tricky. And for me, it was quite a journey. I mean, I think it's still a journey that I'm on and will continue to be on. I feel at this point, I'll be 61 on Sunday, is the point in my life where I do feel the most authentic, a great sense of freedom and joy in my life. And I'm still aware, you know, that there are times where I'm looking externally. I think we all, you know, kind of bounce back and forth in that.
Jackie Shannon Hollis, and she has written a memoir, This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. Jackie, I'd like to skip ahead to when in the first years of marriage to Bill, you had this morning ritual of taking a pill. And I'd like for you to read that section of your book. This is in chapter 27.
Okay.
Do you have that, page 83?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
It's the chapter is Secrets and Calculations. In the first years of my marriage to Bill, I tried to wrangle the baby wanting in me back down. I went on as though nothing had changed, and from the outside, nothing had. Each morning, as I'd done since college, I pressed a tiny yellow pill through the tinfoil at the back of its plastic bubble, cupped my hand to catch it. Bill was asleep or already at work. I was alone in the bathroom. This was my ritual, what I had done for most of 14 years without thinking of what I was saying yes to or saying no to. My periods came every fourth Tuesday in the week of the white sugar pills placed in the packet as markers to keep a woman who didn't want children in the habit of taking her daily pill. But now, on some mornings, I paused. Me, the mirror, these pills. What if I stopped? If Bill didn't know, if I became pregnant anyway, would he finally surrender or would he push me to end the pregnancy? Would he leave? Would he fall in love with the child? The me with the pill in her palm caught eyes with the me in the mirror. The woman I would have to face, the child in her arms come to life from secrets and calculation. A child I didn't want that way, a relationship I didn't want that way. I wouldn't do it. Honesty was what we had, Bill and I, what I valued as much as the way he made me laugh, as much as the way he told me daily that he loved me. We were not made of secrets and calculations.
And that's the title of this chapter, Secrets and Calculations. My guest is Jackie Shannon Hollis, and she was reading from her book, This Particular Happiness, and it has been called a wise, gloriously wise book about your unexpected path to becoming. And there are a lot of things in it, Jackie, that are unexpected. You mentioned being molested, and we're reading along in your book, Everything's Glorious, you're in college. You might tell us what that situation was, how that came about.
Yes. I was 20. I was in the spring, it was in May of my third year of college, and I was at home asleep and woke to a man standing over my bed with a knife, and he raped me over the course of a couple of hours. He was in my apartment and raped me and went through my home and my body, and it was a stunning, shocking, life-changing moment that I didn't know the extent to which for years. It took me a long time to really understand the way that I was changed, because my desire was not to be changed by this event after it happened. So that's the event. And I think it is the reason that it is a part of the story is that one area that it changed in me significantly was my awareness of death and how close death is, the possibility of dying, probably at a younger age than many people understand it, although I think a lot of younger people understand it now than they did back in 1979. But just being changed by the fact of it's easy to die.
Well, it seems pretty common that young women are molested, and in the case they have people guys advances that they don't want, but to be raped at knife point, that I find that hard to. I could see why it would be tough to get over that, get past that.
Yes, yes. And it was also, there was very little conversation at the time about rape. It was not something, I think that there was probably a lot of, until I began to speak about it, I found out there were a number of women at that time who were having, had been sexually assaulted. I think there is, in many of these cases, whether it's someone you know or a stranger, as in my case, the fear of death, of being overpowered, is quite significant. And I've just been listening on audio to the book Missoula by John Krakauer, and he talks about the campus rapes that happened in Missoula as part of the university. And even with people who are known to the victim, there's still that fear of this person could, you know, they're much larger than me. They could break my neck. They could smother me. And I think that that's the fear that happens with many women in that moment, regardless of, like I say, like with me, where it was someone who came inside my apartment with a knife, or a friend who turned on me in some way.
And I think you're right in that at that age, at 20, death is so far in the future that you don't even give it, you don't even think about it at all. It's just not on your radar screen. And here you have something that brings death right up into your face. You can't ignore it like we can, the rest of us can.
Yes, yes. And so I think that that, you know, that carried in me as it informed a lot of things about, especially as time went on, about being present and making choices that, and this circles back to what we were talking about earlier, about understanding what do I want and need, what kind of life, and so being more conscious about choosing the kind of life I wanted. That didn't happen immediately, but over the next number of years, I became much more conscious about what's this life that I want.
And one way you get across to those of us who are reading your book is that you refer to it. I mean, you just don't describe the rape and then you move on and never mention it again. And so we get this feeling that, yeah, you do move on with your life, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that was really difficult for me during that time and for a number of years after. And I think this is often hard for people to understand, is that you know, a traumatic event happens and we can look like we've moved on. And I think it's easy to begin to feel ashamed of wanting to talk about it, of needing to talk about it, but worrying about other people judging, why are you still talking about that? That happened 2 years ago or 5 years ago. And so there's a way of making it smaller and smaller as a way to try to carry it inside ourselves. And really wasn't until I went back to it and began writing about it when I was about 40. And then again, a few years ago, I did a storytelling event where I talked about it in more detail and about this process of trying to carry something like this. And that with many people who have been sexually assaulted, there's both a desire, almost a compulsion to want to talk about it, as strong as a side-by-side, a desire not to talk about it. And it's a very confusing experience.
Well, it's confusing for friends and family that they don't know whether to bring it up. Now, I haven't had much experience with that, but with something like a death in the family, and friends don't want to bring it up because they don't want to hurt your feelings, but yet it's not. And they have a hard time understanding what should their role be? Does she want to talk about it? Does she want to avoid talking about it?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really tricky because, you know, I'm one person and I wanted to talk about it. And there are, and it probably would have been very helpful for me had I been able to talk more. And I think that I probably land on the side that is more typical, is that we do want to talk about it. But I think there are other people who don't want to speak about a sexual assault. But you bring up death, and I think that that's a similar thing. I have a friend whose wife died in January, and I was talking with him the other day, and we just talked about just that struggle of, for him, like going to a store where he and his wife always went, and people wanting to say something and saying something, and how hard it would be every place he went to have a conversation about this. And yet I have had other people this is actually in the story, but a child who died. And one of the things for them that was really important for them was to have their child's name brought up and to have people not, the worst thing was when people didn't say anything to them.
And yet I don't think they realize that.
No,
so
no.
Maybe
Mm-mm.
your book will help in that regard.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to. Go ahead.
Just one thing I was going to say about that. I think that one of the sort of ideal ways to do that is to ask. Mm-hmm. I know, and that is what one person did say to me. I heard something really terrible happen to you, and I'm so sorry. Do you want to talk? And that leaves it in the hands of the person who's going through the experience.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with memoirist Jackie Hollis. Her book is This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Jackie Hollis, and we're talking about her decision not to have children and what we keep and what we abandoned to make space in our lives for love. I would like now to skip to chapter 31.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about expressing your feelings, we think in terms of telling a friend or a family member, saying it in words orally. But there's a section in your book where Bill is writing a letter to his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Would you flip over to page 98, Jackie,
mm-hmm.
in your book?
Yes, got it.
And why was Bill writing a letter to his dad?
Well, his dad, Bill's father, left the family when Bill was one, his sister was two, and his mother was pregnant with Bill's younger brother. And he left the marriage. And his father was in, I believe, the army, and he went to Korea. He was stationed in Korea. And so Bill would write letters to his dad, trying to have a connection with him. So would you like me to read that
part?
Yes,
if you would, please.
Okay. Bill writes a letter like he's learning to write letters in school, 7 years old, and the letter goes like this. Dear Dad, how are you? I am fine. The weather here is nice. And so on. I addressed it, Bill tells me. Mom took me to the post office for stamps. I put the stamps on and put it in the letter slot. This boy in worn pants and worn shoes goes every day to the mailbox next to the road. I waited for weeks, maybe a month, not realizing how long it takes a letter to get to Korea, for another letter to come back from Korea. And one day, a letter is there. He carries it into the house, balanced on the palms of hands, to the bedroom, where he can be alone with his father's letter, addressed just to him. He opens the envelope, unfolds the pages. Here is the letter he wrote to his father, marked up in red ink. Red question mark where the question mark should have been. Crossed out misspelled words. A note. You need to try harder in school. Maybe there's also a letter with Bill's marked up letter. Maybe his dad says something else. What Bill remembers is the red ink, the disappointment.
My guest is Jackie Hollis, and she's reading from her book, This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. And the Bill that she's quoting in here is her husband and writing in, and he says that he's a terrible writer.
Yeah.
Struggle spelling and punctuation.
Yes. For years, I was shocked. Bill is a man who I consider to be quite smart. He knows a whole lot about everything. But his spelling would shock me how bad it was. He, just simple words like pleasant, he would call out to me, can you spell this? And, for a long time, I just didn't understand it. I thought that he was being lazy or obstinate or not trying hard enough. And then he told me this story and it just, everything clicked in place that, my story about his story is that he got frozen in some way, with, that message from his father and that criticism from his father. And he developed a story about himself that he was a terrible writer, speller.
Well, you conclude this chapter with a sentence that I particularly liked. Knowing where your scars come from doesn't make them go away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think, we all have scars and we often all know where they are, but they're still there. And I think that the hope is that we develop some compassion for ourselves in the fact that that's there and there's this work around I may have developed for that. And maybe someday I can soften the scar, it can become more supple. But this is just one of the things that's in me. And the best thing I can do is shine the light on it, not have it be a secret, and have compassion.
Well, I would think that often people who have a childhood like Bill did would seek psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, and I didn't mention this when I introduced you, but your education and work as a counselor pushed you to hold up the mirror to your own self. And so you are a counselor yourself.
Yes, I have a master's in social work, and I don't do that kind of work currently, but I worked for many years as a counselor, primarily in alcohol and drug treatment. And interestingly, Bill also had a degree in counseling. He was a firefighter, but then he also got this degree in counseling. And so he worked for a number of years in emergency services, and we do work together now. We do trainings with people in emergency services on communication, stress management, conflict management, relationships. And so we've taken a number of things that we both learned in our separate educations, our lives. We've also each of us did more personal growth work, and we both also had therapy as well. So we've done quite a bit of work. And even so, I mean, I think it's that thing of knowing where your scars are, even all of that work, we still are in those grooves that we learned to walk in many years ago.
Well, you mentioned you were a counselor, and then when you decided you wanted to be a writer, you wanted a new job, Bill was all for it. He said, yes.
Mm-hmm. So yes. Yeah. It took him a while to get there because I had changed careers. Being a writer isn't the most lucrative business. And so I think it was a big decision on both our parts to let go of the job I had where I had a good income and to take some time and just write. And turns out it was a good decision.
Well, I want to ask you about this question that since I don't have children myself, I have seen this. When I lived in Peru, and I would go to the places to get my hair cut or washed. And the first question I would get from these ladies would be, are you married? I'd say yes. And the second question was, do you have children?
Mm-hmm.
And when I said no, they would often ask, this is all in Spanish, they would say, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Because that was what was expected. So it's not just our culture, other cultures. You are expected, if you're married, you're expected to have a child. And they couldn't fathom that. Why did you not have a child?
Yeah. Yes.
And
that
so,
is,
yeah. So I wanted to get to your chapter 42 because of this, because you got confronted with this question quite commonly, quite often.
Yes. And chapter 42 is, you know, one moment of many, and how do you handle that? And one of the things I just want to say about that is, how rare is it for someone to say to someone who does have children, why do you have children?
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Well, would you read from some of that chapter? This is page 139, Jackie.
Bill sat next to me at a dinner party talking to the man on his other side, not hearing the question that the woman across from me asked. Do you have kids? How many times had I been asked this in the 7 years since Bill and I married? 10, 30, 60? Asked by the man next to me on a plane, the new coworker, the dental hygienist at the dentist's office right before I opened wide. Asked in the same way people who didn't know you might ask, what do you do? Where are you from? An icebreaker, a get to know you, let's find something in common question. This woman asked it in the same way as all the others. Her eyes on me, sure I would say yes, I do, that I would tell her how many, their names, show pictures, the ice would be broken.
This is Jackie Hollis, and she has written a memoir about her exploring whether or not to have children, is what it kind of breaks down to. And if you choose one path, there's always, I think, typically, curiosity about the path not taken. And this is what you explore. You wonder, well, what would it have been like? And you even, at some point, consider freezing Bill's sperm.
Yes. In case he dies
like
before
me. about your mid-30s. So you brought up that subject. And what did Bill think about that?
Oh, I think he thought I was joking about it. I think as I looked back, as I wrote this book and really understood what his experience was as we were going through this, was how much I tamped down my own longing, because we married with the agreement that we wouldn't have children, and with me thinking that would be fine. And then, it changed for me after we were married, and I found out in part about my mother's disappointment and began to experience that sense of being left out of the club. And so it changed for me, and I was trying to sort all that out. And I didn't feel, I wanted to make sure that I didn't resent him and that it didn't damage what we had. So I kept it very quiet. So when I made this joke about freezing, made this comment about freezing his sperm, and there was a part of me that was like, maybe we should do that in case he's 10 years older than me, in case he dies, and then I can go on and have this child. But another part of me was joking. And I think that he responded to the joke, because that's the part in my, you know, the tone of my voice and all of that I put forward as a way of protecting him and protecting my own longing.
Well, you say that Bill actually replies a couple of pages later, if you really want a child, then okay.
Yeah.
And those of us reading
after,
along,
yeah, that's, yes.
We're floored. What? All this time he said no? And he says, oh, well, if you really want it, okay.
Yeah. He, I wore him down, and that was at first hopeful moment, like, oh, he, you know, this is something can happen, but then all of his conditions that came along with that. And what it came down to for me was, you know, maybe I wore him down by, you know, checking and checking and checking again, had he changed his mind, and with my trying to understand why. But ultimately, I didn't want to have a child with someone who wasn't 100% in on it. I didn't want that for him, for me, or for that child.
Well, then you also, and I like these questions you ask because I think they're important. You say, would a child justify me? Would it make me happy? Wasn't I already happy? And you said, I had the life I had because of the absence of a child. Bill and I were free to explore each other and ourselves in uninterrupted time. And so this fact that you cannot, that Bill says no to children, and so you're going along thinking, oh, but I want a child. And then suddenly, but would it make me happy?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, that's the question. I think that often we're looking at, and you said this earlier, what we don't have, the other possible lives. And it's easy to get very distracted off onto that. I know people with children who, while they don't necessarily wish their children away, they wish for a lot of the freedoms that they see childless and child-free people having. And so, yeah.
Well, and I like this happiness. Next paragraph, you say, in wanting this one thing that I didn't have, I was squandering what I did have. Mm-hmm. Here was the rising of that seed of knowledge I had taken in all those years ago when I was raped. Death can come at any moment. Be present, or you will miss your life.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's easy for us to do, to not mm-hmm. be present with our lives and to miss all these joys that arise from one moment to the next.
Yes, yes. And there are so many possible joys to just be, you know, if you just, we sit here and look at the sky or sit with, you know, the person that we love. And there are so many ways to distract from that. It's sad. And so I try to practice the presence.
Well, you mentioned that in this little bio that your publisher sent that you and your husband live in a home that your friends call the treehouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just really lucked out because we have lots of cedar trees behind us and quite a deep ravine that it's impossible to build on. And so the living space of our house is up on what's the second story from when you look out the back. And so it feels like you're sitting in amongst trees and it's pretty peaceful.
So living in a treehouse, you can enjoy that on your own. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Jackie, about your book.
It's been wonderful talking with you, Nancy. I also, you know, read about you and the life that you're living, and it sounds like you are experiencing joy and presence as well.
Thank you. Yes, I have to agree with you. I really do. Remind people that my guest has been Jackie Shannon Hollis, and that her book is This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.